This meeting is now being recorded.
Thank you. Welcome all. This is David McCauley speaking. And we have a small group so far, but in the past, a number of people have come in several minutes late, which is fine. So I would like to press on. We're close to the five-person rule, but I think we're in shape that we can roll on right now. And what I'd like to first do is ask if there's anybody on the audio bridge who is not in the Adobe room to please identify themselves. Hearing none, then ask if there's anybody on the call so far that has any changes to announce to their statements of interest. Hearing none, I'll assume that that's the case. I just heard someone come in on the call. If that's someone that's on the audio bridge only, could they please identify themselves?
This is Reg Levy.
Hi, Reg. David McCauley here. Thank you. That leads into my introduction of Reg. Reg is acting in the capacity of a chairing skills coach to me, and she participated in the last call, and she'll participate in this call in background, not as a participant in the group. And so I appreciate everybody's understanding in that respect. So we've covered the administrative matters, and I'd like to get into the agenda. And again, we're a small group, but we have enough to press on, and would like to make a record and press on and get to some of these issues. So I hope that you have seen the agenda that I sent out earlier in the week. Once we get past the administrative stuff, we move next to the work timeline and the impact on the staff report, and I hope you've had a chance to look at that. I'd like to discuss it now. The current timeline looks for us to have a staff report done on our work on the public comments to the draft rules by March the 29th. Obviously, that's no longer going to work. And so we need to set a new date, and we need to do it in this meeting in order to have sufficient time that the changed date can be announced prior to the 29th, and it takes a little bit of time to do that. In my memo, I suggested that we move it to May the 29th, if I'm not mistaken. That's the date I said. And what would happen between here – I'm sorry, did somebody want to say speak up? Oh, I might have heard something.
No, it was just me, David. I was just saying correct.
Okay, thanks, Bernie. What has to happen between here and the new date, whatever date we choose, is we need to – let me just stop for a second and ask if the person that just joined is on audio only. Would they please identify themselves?
Hi, this is Liz Light from ICANN.
Thank you. We're just talking about a new date for the staff report. The things that have to happen between here and that staff report are we need to complete our work, that is, come to consensus on how we're going to handle public comments. And as you know, there's a number of comments, some of them complex and very good, thoughtful comments that we need to work through. In addition, we need to pass our thoughts past Sidley, I believe, at least in my opinion we do, to make sure that we get a reality check so that what we're doing, what we're suggesting, passes legal muster. We need to then hand it over to staff so that they can write it up with some direction from us as to what we intend and have all that done by May the 29th. If we choose that date, which I'm suggesting, there's still a lot of work to do between here and there, and there's nothing that there's no rule against us beating that date. So I'm now going to open the floor to anybody that would like to have any comments on setting a new date and that being the date, that is May the 29th. If anybody would like to say anything, please feel free. I'm not seeing any hands, and so I'm wondering if I could see green ticks or expressions of aye, if that means that people are agreeing to the new date of May the 29th. Okay, I see. Is there anybody that wants to put a red tick up and object to that date? You can clear the green ticks now. I see no objections, and so I am going to assume then that we have just set the date of May the 29th, and so I'll mention to Bernie and Brenda to please act on that as the new date and do what you need in that respect. I see Caboose's notes in the chat asking me to slow down, and I'll do my best to do that. Thank you, Caboose. Next on the agenda is a brief report by me to this group about some comments I made during ICANN 58 in Copenhagen. And it's something that we've expressed in our letters to SOs and ACs as well. And that is, we have notified SOs and ACs that under the bylaws, specifically 4.3J, they have a role coming up now in the fairly near future to consider people who apply to become members of the standing panel. And then the SOs and ACs have the lone role of nominating people to the standing panel, at least seven. And the bylaws are perfunctory in this respect. It really just sort of indicates that they'll do it. What it says in 4.3J is the supporting organizations and advisory committees shall nominate a slate of proposed panel members from the well-qualified candidates identified per the process. And so they're going to need help. And I have said that the IOT would be willing to act in a helpful capacity. I need to, and it's something I think we've discussed before, but I just wanted to make sure it's on our radar screen. We can discuss it soon. I might instigate a discussion on the list, thoughts on how we might do this. We might create a small team to do it, to be helpful. We might do it as a group. If anybody has any thoughts on this topic, I would open the floor to them now to sort of help us move this particular bit forward. Okay, I may then instigate a discussion on the list, but this group, the SOs and ACs, are going to need help organizing themselves. Our role would be administrative, not inserting ourselves in their role of nominating, but helping them with our understanding of the bylaws, et cetera. Next, we move on to public comments review. Before we move to the timing issue and Malcolm, let me again mention that I need volunteers. Before I do that, I want to note that Caboose's hand is up. Caboose, please take the floor.
Yes, you have asked SO and AC to nominate the member candidates of the member of the panel. The qualification of those people is those which are referred in the bylaw. Is that so?
Yes, that's correct, Caboose. The 4.3J and 4.3Q, I think, are the sections in the bylaws that describe the qualifications that someone would have to become a member of the standing panel. And so, as I understand it, ICANN will release an expression of interest, and I'm going to ask Sam to comment on that in just a minute, an expression of interest document inviting people to apply to become members. And from the bucket or the pool of people that do apply, ICANN, the board, the SOs and ACs will parse through those applications to sort of put them in two separate piles, those who are very well qualified and those who may be qualified but don't fit into the well-qualified bucket. And then from the well-qualified candidates, the SOs and ACs will nominate members to the standing panel. That nomination, by the way, is subject to board approval, not to be unreasonably withheld. Does that answer your question, Caboose?
Yes, answered my question, but something that perhaps you have not covered during the vote testing one in the bylaw about the qualification, and I don't want to change anything to add anything, but something implicitly should be understood that the persons among the qualification must or should have been involved in the issue of the of the IRP during the first vote stream. I have heard some people, there have never been any discussion and so on and so forth, and they may line up other people to support them. So the qualification is not only something that people could judge, but some background experience in the preparation, in the discussions, knowing all of these things. So I don't know how I can take that into account. I hope that they will take into account in the first list, which I call them a short list, or call them the list which we prepared for participants to be designated by the SO and AC. So I'm just referring to the ICAM to be quite sure that the people have all qualifications required, because this is a very, very sensitive and very important issue, member of the panel. Thank you.
Thank you, Caboose. Sam, you have your hand raised, so I will invite you to take the floor.
Thanks, David. So just on a bit of an admin, the administrative side, where our internal team is working on finalizing a document that we'll be previewing with this group before we would post it on ICANN's website. We think that it's appropriate to get the view of the IoT on the document, check that we're meeting the spirit of the bylaws and the qualifications that we're putting up and the things that we're including in there. And then to Caboose's point, you know, we're drafting to the specifications that are in the bylaws, and again, the IoT will have a chance to look at it. And then there is, as David was noting, there is a vetting process, right? So we go through and we check out what's well-qualified, or we make the list of well-qualified, and then work with the SOs and ACs to then make their appointments. And so if there are other qualifications that aren't necessarily listed in the documents, but that the SOs and ACs wish to apply against that list of the well-qualified applicants, you know, that's something that, you know, surely the community could discuss how they wanted to do that and that work, to take into account the types of experience, Caboose, that you're bringing in. But, you know, we're, from our side, we're drafting it to the bylaws and some general standards, and aren't trying to insert any additional requirements that weren't vetted earlier.
Thank you, Sam. Do you have any guesstimate on timing that you'll give us the document to take a look at?
Yeah, you know, we're just doing a final pass through it, and I know I'd hoped that we had something out last week during Copenhagen, but we weren't able to do that, but we're confident we can get something out to you guys next week.
Thank you, Sam. Okay, so moving on, I'm going to ask Malcolm to take the floor in just a minute. And what the goal here is to follow up on Malcolm's discussion last week addressing the issue of the time for filing claims, which was the subject of a number of comments, not least Malcolm's own. And I will ask you, Malcolm, as you go through this, to please keep an eye on time, and we're going to hope to move along. I would like very much to get into the next issue on Joinder during this call. And so, Malcolm, I will pay attention to the queue, but I may also put my hand up, because if I have comments, I'll be commenting as a participant, not as the lead. And so I'll be watching the queue for you, but if it's okay, I'll hand you the floor now.
Thank you, David, and if you would indeed call people from the queue, that'd be appreciated. And apologize to anyone on the call that finds it hard to understand me. I'm afraid I'm suffering from a bit of a cold at the moment. I hope you can hear clearly. Okay, so to run through this quickly, firstly, the last meeting we had, which was slightly sparsely attended, wasn't really a decision-making meeting. It was one where we provided the analysis of the public comments received. And I had, as preparation, done a breakdown of that, which was presented to the meeting, and we had a discussion, but no decisions were taken. In short, though, to summarize very briefly, there were a considerable number of comments that objected to the way the timing rule had been presented, on the grounds that it was either A, too short, or that the basis on which the calculation was done was was wrong in their opinion in that it needed to be based on the when the harm was done or when the harm was known to the claimant rather than on a fixed date of the date of the action that might prevent a claimant from raising a claim at all. So there was a discussion about that, but no conclusions were reached. I did suggest that there was one point out of the public comments that was the first threshold question that would need to be reached before we before we went through any further issues, which was the proposal from the business constituency and the ISPCP that there should simply be a moratorium on the timing issue. Nobody on that call said that there was any support for that. But if there is not support for that, then we need to look at options for moving forward. And the structure of the rest of the session that I've got in this slide deck shows basically the main focus on that main point of contention as to how the time is calculated and also how long it should be. And then a small number of relatively minor and relatively uncontentious points that have also been raised that should be given due consideration but are not likely to be as substantial a point of discussion as that main issue. So I would first ask, is there anyone on this call that would now wish to step in and speak for them in favour of just simply a moratorium and thus dropping this topic? If there are none, I see David. David, your hand is up. If you would like to...
Sorry, I'm speaking to a muted phone.
If you'd like...
Malcolm, I did want to just say I've paid very close attention to the list, and other than in the comment, I haven't seen support for a moratorium, and I personally, as a participant, would argue against a moratorium. I think we need to move on and get the rules in place. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Well, speaking personally, I would have been content with that as an outcome, but I see no support for it. And so speaking in a sort of subdivision chair role, I think we can now say that there is just simply no support for this as a proposal, and we can now deem it discarded. So if we can now move to the next slide, the staff will now move to the next slide as to how time is calculated. This raises what I think is the main issue that has been raised, and in particular, on this next slide, we see the proposal that David brought up on the last call and that he and I have worked together to formulate in a more clear words that would attempt to resolve the main issue that was raised by most of the participants in the respondents to the public comments. And that proposal is this. It is to say that the rule on timing should be that a claimant must file their claim no later than the later of the two following dates. That's so many days after the date of the harm, or, if later, so many days after the date that the claimant became aware of the harm or ought reasonably to have been aware of it. So the effect of that would be, if we pick, for example, 6 months, that would say that 6 months after you've been harmed, that's the time you've got for filing. You've got to do it within 6 months after you've been harmed, unless, for some reason, you weren't aware that you'd been harmed. And if that were the case, then it would be 6 months after when you were aware that you'd been harmed, or if it's a shorter time than that, when you ought reasonably to been aware of it. And I should clarify this second bullet point here. That does mean when you ought to have been aware of it or when you were actually aware of it. If you should have been aware of it beforehand, then that's the date that counts. But in practicalities, it's likely to mean so many dates after the harm, unless there's some reason that you don't know, and then when it is that you do know or should have known. So that's the proposal that David brought up in the last meeting, and there was no disagreement with it in the last meeting, but it was sparsely attended. We worked on it together. We both believe that this would address the main gravamen of the objections that were raised by the public commenters, so I put it to the group. And
okay.
I see David's hand and Cavusa's hand. David, are you first or is that an old hand?
No, that's a new hand, and thank you, Malcolm. And I think you alluded to it, but the one thing that I wanted to mention about this slide is I agree with you that if we can come up with whatever the number of days is, you know, 45, 90, 180, whatever goes in as double X, if we can agree on that, then I'm fine with this, except to say that, just to be a little bit more clear about it, I think you said this, but to be a little bit more clear, the subparagraph 2, where it says X days after the date claimant became aware of the harm or ought reasonably to have been aware of it, to me, that would be best qualified by saying whichever of those two dates is earlier. And so I agree that it would be the later of the two dates, but with respect to this subparagraph alone, I think there's two potential dates there. When someone became aware of the harm or should have been aware of the harm, the operative date there in that subparagraph is whichever of those two is earlier. That's my comment. Thank you.
Okay. So if we then add the words if earlier, just on the end of that second subclause, so it reads XX days after the claimant became aware of the harm, or would reasonably to have been aware of it if earlier, would that satisfy?
Yes, I think so. Yes. Thank you,
David. Caboose. Caboose, we can't hear you. If you're muted, please check the mute button.
I believe Caboose has been disconnected, and we are attempting to recontact him at this point.
Okay. If you are trying now, we will wait briefly in the hope that he can reconnect now. I see Caboose is typing in the chat.
While we're waiting for Caboose, I'm just wondering if anyone has thoughts on what should be the double X. What's the number of days? It sounds like 45 was not well received, and there have been some other suggestions. Did you want to address that now, Malcolm, or do you want to wait for that?
Well, I was waiting for Caboose, but yes, I can briefly say that the main – hi, is that Caboose joining the call?
Yes, I am on the call. Sorry, just one small comment. What do you mean not later than the later? This is not quite. This is very awkward. Not later than the later.
Perhaps it would be more elegant to say before the later of the following day.
There's some different type of wording, but not later than the later. But not later than the later. It is not understandable for many people like me. Maybe for you it's good, but for me it doesn't have any sense. Thank you.
Okay, I see people in the chat saying, Caboose, that they found it hard to hear you, but if I may repeat what I understood you to say, I've found the phrase not later than the later to be inelegant and difficult to understand. I hope that it could be rephrased in a way that was easier to be understood, which I'm sure can be done. I think at this stage we are looking for the principle here, and I'm sure the lawyers will find a way of phrasing it that works best, but we're looking for the principle. So maybe if it's a claimant must file their date before the later of the following two dates or something like that, any other phrasing that means the same thing I'm sure would be acceptable.
Malcolm, you have a hand up from Sam.
Sam, please go ahead.
Hi, Malcolm. Thanks. This is Sam Eisner from ICANN Legal. I just wanted to find out if with this phrasing there is the IOT is considering removing the suggestion that there is any outside time limit on an IRP, and it's solely based on when someone would find out about harm. Is that what I should understand?
It's not only based on when someone finds out about harm. It is based on, firstly, on the date that the harm occurs, or, if later, the date that they find out about it or ought to have found out about it.
So right.
We would expect that in most cases it would be based on the date that the harm occurs, although there is a possibility that if the claimant wasn't aware of the harm at that time, it could be extended, but no later than when they reasonably ought to have been aware of it. Sam, if you are alluding to the change from a fixed date that it bears no reference to the date of the harm, I would refer you in part to the legal advice we received from our independent counsel, which said that we needed to move away from a fixed date to one based on the date of knowledge. And we are in some respects responsive to that.
Right. So I understand the need for I'm basing something on the timing of a date from when harm was occurred. That's not what I'm asking about. But for the subsection 2, how long after an act could someone bring a claim? That's what I'm trying to, whether we put in 180 days in there or whatever, I'm not talking about how we fill in the XX, but, you know, is this something that a claimant could bring 5 years after? You know,
well,
is that a reasonable reading of this? That's what I'm trying to get to.
I think it would be really most unlikely that anyone would say that it took 5 years for them to become aware that they had been harmed by it and to sustain that was a reasonable for them not to have been aware of it for that long. Yes. So what we're really looking at in that subparagraph is, yes, if it's based from the date of the harm, if you weren't aware of it immediately, then you can have longer, but only so long as reasonable, such that you ought reasonably to have been aware of it.
And while Sam is considering your response, Malcolm, I just wanted to note that you have two hands following Sam. Cavus is next, and then after Cavus is Greg Chatton.
And I think while Sam is considering that, we'll move to Cavus. Cavus, please go ahead. You have the
floor. Do you hear me, please? Now?
Yes, we can hear you, Cavus. Yes, we can hear you.
Go ahead.
Yes, I'm sorry, Malcolm might have something in mind. I don't understand the difference between 1 and 2. Let me explain. A harm occurred. Someone, is called the claimant, identify that harm. Then what you are saying in 1 and what you are saying in 2, what they are two different, the harm and being aware of the harm. What is the difference between two? What we are going to say here is not very clear. Could you kindly explain that? What do you mean by 1 and 2? One of them, either of them is understandable, but both of them I don't understand. You want a replacement? This is alternative. Could you please kindly explain? If there are alternatives, I could agree with any of them, which people agree, but if there are both of them are reconsidered, they are not quite easy to understand. Thank you.
Cavus, I think it is possible there is a tautology in here. It may well be that the second paragraph includes the first. But we would expect that in most cases the claimant was aware of the harm at the moment that it occurred, at the instant that it occurred. And it would only be in exceptional cases when the claimant was not aware of it. And that's why it has been described in this fashion. But I think that we should try to get away from the precise wording of this. What we're looking for is an agreement on principle here. Do we agree on this basic principle? And if we do, then we can leave it to the lawyers to find some way of phrasing it more elegantly than I have been able. Does that satisfy Cavus?
Yes, if you talk about principle, for the time being, both principle 1 and 2 will be there, right? It's not selection of 1. So both of them you want to keep, and then later on, at the end, we will opt for one of them, but not for both, right?
I think if I understand what you're saying correctly, yes.
Okay.
Greg, you have the floor.
Okay, thank you.
Greg Shafton, you have the floor.
Sorry, it took a while to get to my mute button. We do need both one and two, and they're not the same, and I don't know whether, you know, two will be an exceptional case or not. One covers the date on which some harm actually occurs, and two covers the date that the plaintiff or claimant here found out that the harm occurred or should have found out the harm occurred if they had been acting, you know, reasonably. Now, it may, there are a number of different ways. I don't know if we need to go through hypotheticals on the, an example that has no capacity, has no relevance to ICANN, but it's an easy one. If you have a house in the woods, very far from the nearest neighbor, and it burns down on July 1st, you don't go there until August 1st. July 1st is the date from which one counts from, and August 1st would be the date of two. And if there's some unreasonable amount of time to spend away from one summer home, even if you never go to the summer home and never actually find out about it, if it should be assumed that you would have somebody reasonably looking on your house at least a couple of times a year, then the day you reasonably ought to be aware of it would be, say, 6 months after it happened. Now, you could argue about the exact points, but the point is that these are three different points in time, and, you know, all of them need to be considered as, you know, potential end date. If you go only after the date of the harm, then you exclude, you're basically creating a per se rule based on the date of occurrence that has nothing to do with the particular circumstances of the plaintiff, and that can be very unfair to a plaintiff who does not become aware of things. And, again, we could run through a number of hypotheticals. I'm sure we could think of some where awareness would not become immediate, for instance, a policy as well. You know, the harm may take a while to occur. The harm may take a while to be seen. The harm may take a while to be reasonably have been seen. Finally, I would say that this kind of two-prong construction here is absolutely bog standard for these kinds of legal end dates. We could, you know, quibble about the language here or there. I'm sure that there's some canned language we could find that's maybe a little better, but conceptually this is spot on, and I don't think we need to do anything to change this. There is the point that Sam raised, which is the point of absolute of repose, whether there will be some sort of date after which the act occurred, as opposed to, you know, a harm-based case. And that's, you know, a question. I guess it's supposed a lot of that is based I'm not sure why you have difficulty following the logic. Your house burns down on July 1st. You don't know about it. August 1st, you go and see that your house burnt down. Then you know about it. You never go to your house. At some point, you should have gone to your house. You should have been aware of it. Those are the three dates. They're all difficult. They're all different. And all of those should be taken into account.
Thank you, Greg.
I think one of the issues just finally is, if we're talking about changes to the bylaws, I'm not sure that there should ever be repose in challenging a harm that results from a change to the bylaws. So I think we need to talk about what acts we're talking about before we make any blanket rules. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Greg. Sam, you have the floor.
Yeah, thanks. I think we're converging. The issue of whether one and two make sense, I think they do, right? You know, we can refine the language a bit, but I think the concepts in there of timing it from that are important. I do think, as Greg was phrasing it, that the issue of ultimate repose, you know, I think we still have an obligation to look at the purposes of the IRP to say when, if the purposes of the IRP and accountability are to reach some point of certainty of action, and that things will stand, that
that were done, that maybe it does make sense to have some sort of external time limit on it as well, the repose, right, for, you know, if something didn't cause harm within, if people didn't find out it didn't cause harm within 5 years, why would we entertain it and upset everything that's been relying upon that issue for 5 years because someone decided that they were harmed by it earlier, right? Maybe that's an issue that instead needs to be handled in a different way. Maybe circumstances have changed such that a policy really needs to be changed instead of being challenges against the bylaws. You know, there could be multiple things that need to happen. And so I think we still need to keep in mind the ultimate purpose of the IRP and considering whether or not there's an outside limit on the issue of repose while we still maintain this, the time frame dating from when you found out when the harm happened or when you should have known about the harm. I think that the 1 and 2 here aren't necessarily problematic. It's the question of could you always bring a harm even if it happened 5, 10 years later. That's the issue that I think we're concerned about.
Thank you, Sam. Okay, in reply, I think I can summarize then. As regards what is taken in this point, there appears to be a consensus of support for this approach, although it can be handed over to the lawyers to refine the wording of it. Sam is still raising the question of repose, and Greg noted that was a separate issue. But on the other hand, it's noted that all the public comments that spoke to this issue spoke against the principle of repose, and our independent legal counsel had advised us that the principle of repose was not consistent with the bylaws as they stand today. So I would recommend to the group that we agree that further repose beyond this is not something that we can do. It's not within our power to recommend to do. I see Cavus saying that you oppose such a complicated and complex concept. Cavus, we are saying that we will refine and clarify how this is put, but the principle here is that you must file no later than the date of harm, or if it's later than that, the date that you should reasonably have become aware of the harm or actually did become aware of it. And if you should reasonably have become aware of it before you became aware of it, then it's when you should reasonably become aware of it that matters. And I don't know how to put it more clearly than that, but I'm sure the lawyers will help.
Malcolm, it's David.
I don't know if I can move on or if I should continue, if we should continue to take this topic. David, please.
Thank you. I wanted to do two things. One is, as a leader of the call, let me just ask. I heard a phone entry, and so I wanted to ask if there is someone that's now participating who is on audio only and has not identified themselves before. If so, would they please identify themselves?
This is Reg again. I got disconnected.
Thanks, Reg. And then, Malcolm, I just wanted to comment, too, and I mean, I think Sam and Greg get to the difficulty here because there is, and I agree that you and I worked up what's on the screen. I have no problem with that, and I certainly agree with that. But the question has been raised is should there be, in addition to this, a third paragraph that says, in any event, there is a period or a date of repose. And what we're trying to do is balance equities between claimants and ICANN. And there is equity on both sides, I think, to be served. The one thing I wanted to note as I was listening to Sam is that in the IRP process, it's not the only remedy that someone has. There's always litigation. You know, someone could go to a court somewhere if they have a true grievance. So
I'm not sure that's correct. In many cases, contracted parties, I believe, give up the right to go to a court and submit to the IRP as their only form of possible arbitration. Is that not correct?
Okay. That's a fair point.
At least
that's
in some cases?
That's a fair point. Thank you. But I guess what I'm getting at, too, is the equities on both sides. So, I mean, I can see the reasonableness of this. I do want to ask you to move, to sort of move on. I think you can move on. But my hope, and I think the hope of others, that we could close this issue today, we might give Sam a chance on the list or whatever to come back. I mean, she asked, where did this comment from Sidley come from, to maybe look at this a little bit more closely and specifically. So I think we're making great progress. I don't have any quarrel with that. But we might have to do some work on list following it up. I would encourage you to move on if you can, unless someone wants
okay.
to comment.
Okay, in that case, I'll move on. We'll note that this is still a topic that there is an Sam is raising an objection to.
I would like
to read into the record a comment in Greg makes in chat to change no later than to on or before, which achieves the same effect while avoiding the double use of the word later, which Cavus in particular was objecting to. So before we move on, I'd like to read that into the record. And now if we can move to the next slide, please, so that we look at, regardless of how the timing is calculated, we have the question of of how long is allowed based on when it's calculated.
But Malcolm, Malcolm, you have one remaining hand from Cavus.
Oh, I do? Oh, please, Cavus. I beg your pardon, please. Cavus, please go ahead. Cavus, you're mute. Cavus, we cannot hear you.
Can you hear me, please?
Yes, now we can.
We can hear you now. Please go ahead.
Yes, yes. I would say that we need some sort of preamble for one and two. Like one, before talking of the date, we should say harm is occurred and claimant is aware of the harm on the date of its occurrence. Then you introduce one. Two, harm is occurred and the claimant is not aware of the harm until later date. Then we have to distinguish between the two before going any date.
Thank you.
Two different cases. So it would be defined to quite clearly mention what is the two cases. Thank you.
Thank you, Cavus. Okay, moving to the next issue. Regardless of what we decide on the previous issue, we have the question of how would the XX be filled out? We had previously said 45 days to file, and most public commenters responded. In fact, I think every public commenter that spoke to this issue said that 45 days was too short. The most popular suggestion was 180 days or 6 months, and the second most popular suggestion was 90 days or 3 months. I simply turned to the group and asked if for views on what would be an appropriate balance to strike.
Malcolm, hi, it's David, and I've raised my hand as a participant. And again, let me do two things. Let me just read Sam's comment, which is a wrap up on the issue we just discussed, and sort of is a prelude, I think, to what she'll say on the list. And that is, Sam's comment is, from what we can find on Sidley's advice, they noted that a 1-year bar on claims could stand, and they provided other advice on the facial invalidity issue that we are no longer discussing. Now, turning to the number of days. It seems that the most popular was 180 and the second most popular was 90. Maybe we could come to something in the middle, like 120. 180 seems long to me, but that's just my personal view. I recognize that 45 days may be too quick within which to react, but I could vote for 90 or 120. That would be, you know, I would be supporting something like that. Thank you.
Okay, there was, I note that links did not actually recommend a particular time, but said that the test that we should ask ourselves is how long is so long that it would undermine the ability of the IRP to reach a fair decision. So perhaps I could ask the group, how long do you think would be too long that would such that memories would fade, evidence would disappear, and then the IRP couldn't reach a fair decision. Opinions, please. Cavus, your hand is raised, please. Go ahead.
Yes, my hand is raised because we have discussed at the beginning about the 45 days and we proposed that. So when the state is most popular or less popular, I think it's based on few comments. I think it should be quite logical and not to propose a longer time. So I'm in favor of maximum 90 days, but not more than that. Thank you.
Okay, Cavus in favor of maximum 90 and more than. I read Greg in the chat saying 120 days, done. I think that means agreement. We need to look at the timing of the empowered community and give it time to work. Okay, so we have, as I say, most popular suggestion for 180, then 90. Cavus also saying no more than 90. And then a compromise being offered and seconded at 120. Is it possible for us to compromise on 120? It would be very useful if we could get this cleared up. If we could agree a compromise at this now, we would achieve something with school, which would be personally pleased me. We could close out an issue. Do I hear anyone objecting to us agreeing a compromise on 120? Greg Chatham says, if it works for the EC. Okay. David, your hand was briefly raised. Do you wish to say it?
Well, I was going to say I could support Cavus, too. I was either 90 or 120. If there's a hard feeling that more than 90 is too much, I could easily support 90, or I could support a compromise. I just want to go beyond 45. I think that's fair, and I'd like to stay under 180. I think that's excessive myself. It's a personal view. That's all I'm expressing.
Okay. My personal view is actually that we are asking ourselves the wrong question as to how long is necessary and should instead be asking how long impairs the operation of the IRP. I don't think that 180 days impairs the operation of the IRP, so I would go for whatever is the longest compromise we could raise. So I'll add myself to the voices in a personal context for 120. But David, you seem to be content with either 90 or 120.
I am, and I would simply ask if there's anyone in the group that would object to 120. I know Cavus has mentioned a hard cap of 90 days. Is there anyone else that would object to 120? Cavus, your hand is up again.
Yes, if everybody agrees with 120, I don't want to be the only one objecting from 120. I could go with the others. If everybody agrees with 120, thank you.
Cavus, your spirit of compromise is greatly appreciated, and I'm delighted that we can close out one of the issues on this difficult topic on this call. Thank you. Please let the record reflect that the group has agreed on 120 days as a compromise figure. Bernie notes that there are 10 minutes left in the call. Now, there are some other issues that were raised, but the issue that we've just dealt with is the most complex and difficult topic. The remaining slides I have show what those issues are, and we will have to come to them at some time. But I turn to David to ask, would you like me to proceed through those issues, or would you like to proceed to the other non-timing-related issues in this call?
Malcolm, David. Thank you. Thank you, Malcolm. David here. I would like to pursue the timing issues henceforth on the list. And let me, if it's okay, I would like to initiate a discussion about the joinder issue. But saying that, we've recognized Sam has some comments to make on list, and there are some additional issues, as you point out. I think we've made great progress, and I thank you, Malcolm, for taking the lead on this. But let me move to the next issue if no one has any concern with that. And so, Brenda, if you could put the other slides up, the ones that I sent. And let me just begin. The slides, by the way, are really just talking points. But what I put up on the first slide is, as we consider issues resolving joinder, let's remember two fundamental bylaw provisions that are sort of the backdrop for this discussion and all discussions. And one is that the IRP is intended to secure just resolution of disputes, and that the IRP, the rules of procedures of the IRP, are meant to ensure fundamental fairness and due process. And so in that context, I wanted to note that a number of commenters talked about joinder. And if we could go to the next slide, or if people have scrolled, just look at the next slide. And we have joinder issues raised in the context of parties that were involved in other panel decisions below. For instance, we're talking here specifically about expert panel decisions, which are now subject to IRP review. These are things like string confusion and legal rights objections, those kind of things. And so there's a request that people who effectively won their cases below are not ignored if a claimant that is unsatisfied with that panel's decision goes to IRP and can have a right to join. That's one of the issues about joinder. The second bullet says that there's an issue over should a procedures officer from the panel, a single procedures officer, decide questions of joinder, or should the panel decide questions of joinder. And then I think it was the IPC said there should be a page limitation on written statements. Not a page limitation, but an express indication that there isn't a page limitation for other parties to come. So if we can move down, if you can scroll down to the next slide, I mentioned two parties that commented. One is a law firm, Fletcher, Hild, and Hildreth. I think it's Robert Baldwin was the author, but there's another author here who's the prime mover in this particular case, and that's Kathy Kleiman, who many of us know as a participant in the GNSO. And then the GNSO's IPC also commented, and I should note that the non-commercial stakeholder group, and I failed to put them on the slide, that was my inadvertence, the non-commercial stakeholder group has made points that largely are similar to those made by the law firm Fletcher, Hild, and Hildreth. And Kathy and Robert Baldwin's note asked for a couple of things to be done in the joinder issue. I see I have 6 minutes left, so I'm basically setting the table for further discussion. One is they would like actual notice to go to all of the original parties in the expert panel decision that's being challenged. Two, they ask for a mandatory right of intervention, that is for people to be able to join, to people who were parties in the panel. That doesn't mean they have to intervene. That means they have a right to intervene. And then three, there would be a right for parties to be heard prior to an IRP panel making an award of some intermediate remedy, like putting something on hold, putting an action on hold. It's intermediate relief. Those are the things that motivated them, and they thought that these rules should address. The IPC said, and by the way, the non-commercial stakeholder group followed very much along those lines. The IPC did as well, saying, using the words, quote, directly involved, close quote, in the action below, should have a right to intervene. And I believe it was the IPC that said anybody that comes in as a party should have the ability to file equally detailed statements, whatever the limit is. I think it's 25 pages. And so there are ways that we can approach this. I think that it's a fair request that people involved below who won at the expert panel and now see their win being challenged should be able to be parties and should have a right to be parties. I can see that. We can also consider whether there's ancillary parties that might have a right to file an amicus brief, a friend of the court kind of brief. But as I set the table, I shouldn't take up all the airtime. And so let me just open the floor to ask if people want to comment on this subject. I mean, we're going to have to do more work on it. I'll have to address it in our next call. But are there people that would like to make a comment? And I see Sam Eisner's hand is up, so I'm going to ask Sam to comment.
Thanks, David. So this it's not about actually the substance of the recommendations and joinder and the question of whether or not people are appropriate to be part of it, particularly if it relates to an extra panel decision that other parties were involved in, et cetera. I think we do need to be careful as we consider these that we recall what the definition of disputes are
and that we don't write rules that allow people to relitigate a panel decision through the IRP, but make sure that anyone that we would allow joinder, or for this instance, using the example of the expert panel, that it's tethered to whether or not that expert panel decision resulted in a violation of ICANN's bylaws or articles, and that we make sure that we tailor any joinder to supporting that discussion within the IRP, because we're not granting the IRP the ability to relitigate things. We're granting the IRP the ability to make a determination on whether or not an action violated ICANN's articles or bylaws. And so I think we just need to be careful as we do our, if we do intend to include joinder rules, that we make sure that the purpose of them is well described and limited to the purposes of the IRP.
Thanks, Sam. David here. I think that's an excellent comment, and I was basically assuming it, but I think I should have said it. And so I agree. None of the things that we're talking about should enlarge or can, in my opinion, enlarge on what the bylaws provide. And so the people that are theoretically joining as parties that would be considered under joinder here are going to be sort of on ICANN's side of things, I guess. In other words, defending the case against the claimant. And so I think my expectation is that the claimant's going to be bound to make the claim that the panel decision violated the articles or the bylaws. And it's going to be a high bar to meet. So I think you made a very good point. Thank you for that. I promise to the group to address this further in our next call. By the way, our next call is next week. Is that correct, Bernie?
Yes, I've posted it in the chat.
Okay, thanks, Bernie.
David, it's not 27. 27 of March is Monday. Thursday is not 27.
Oh. I believe the call is on Thursday, a week from today, which we would be 30.
Yeah.
Thank you, Caboose. I don't. But in any event, I have to go through this a little bit further, but I wanted to set the table and start the juices flowing on this issue because I'm going to be looking for comments next week. It seems to me that there are some legitimate comments about people having a right to join as a party, and I think that if you take a look at the slides and maybe some of the comments, those three comments, non-commercial stakeholder group, IPC, and the law firm Fletcher, Hild & Hildreth, you'll get a good feel for what the issues are. And I look forward to further discussion. We have about a minute for any other business, and so I'll ask if anybody has any other business that they would like to raise. And then I will simply mention I'm going to come out in the list and talk a little bit more about people volunteering and how we might be able to manage the comments and move them forward. Anybody want to make any comment? Seeing none, I would like to thank everybody for what I think was a productive call and everybody's participation, and look forward to chatting next week and seeing you all on the list. So that will be the end of this call. Thank you.